Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a lot of great information for you today, starting with dietitian Kim Airy talking about how to stay on track with proper eating over the holiday season. Author Christina Brockett lets us know about some unique and helpful tips on parenting to help you succeed with your kids. Canadian artist and DJ Glenn Morrison talks about his career, which stems from classical music training on the piano. We wrap things up with lifestyle expert Christine Eisner on how to prepare your home for the holidays.
Capture your need for sound.
The holiday season is here, and with that comes some delicious holiday foods. Dietitian Kim Airy joins us to talk about tips and ideas on ways to enjoy the holiday season without losing out on nutrition. Kim, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's great to be here, Kelly.
Kim, when it comes to some of the most delicious foods, what kinds of food should people try, I guess, to stay away from? And I know that's hard to say in the holidays because it's like, it's all of a sudden, it's like a free-for-all.
Well, for me, the best thing is for you to find your favorites and the ones that you're only going to get at Christmas.
Okay.
So there's no point in eating, you know, chips, because you can buy chips 365 days a year. Mm-hmm. There's no point in wasting time and energy on something you can have all the time. What you want to splurge on is things that you really love and that you're only going to get at Christmas. So, you know I only get stuffing at Christmas. I only get it on Christmas Day at my sister-in-law's house. Nobody else makes stuffing, and certainly not stuffing like hers. Hers is delicious. So I'm going to eat some stuffing. I won't eat the mashed potatoes. I eat mashed potatoes all the time.
Right. Okay. That's a wise way of looking at things, because I think maybe if people thought about it like that, they wouldn't think they were missing out, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's really important to focus on your favorites, too. I mean, you know, mashed potatoes I can get all year round anywhere, you know, and yeah, as good and not as good, you know, they're pretty good. Mm-hmm. But the stuffing is only going to be then. There are definitely things that you have at holiday time that you're only getting at those meals, right? You're not eating them any other time. So that's the time to really enjoy them and to savor them and not waste your time and effort on other things. So I know even if we look at the dessert table, there's usually a lot of desserts. Usually at Christmas time, people make more than one dessert. Mm-hmm. And again, the strategy there is to pick your favorite. Sit back and really think hard, which one here is my favorite?
Okay.
And take your favorite. Don't waste your time having the fudge if you don't like the fudge, or the, you know, chocolate chip cookies, because you can make chocolate chip, you know, but you're not going to make, there are some desserts we definitely only make at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm. I actually feel this way about my mom's chicken sandwiches. We only get them on Christmas morning. And they are awesome. And we
there
only get them on Christmas. So it's like, and it's like me and my sister and my brother, even though we're adults, basically push each other out of the way to get to these sandwiches. I wanted to ask you as well about grazing. Because let's say you are at a holiday party or whatever, and there's all these things. Like, I often find at holiday party, you know, you've got Swedish meatballs, and then there's some sort of nacho chip dip and all this kind of stuff. Does grazing get you into trouble at holiday parties?
It can. And so a couple of strategies for that is to let your eyes do a lot of the grazing. You know, we eat with our eyes as well as our stomachs, right? Mm-hmm. So take the time to really look, because one of the issues is kind of like, if you haven't really looked over a buffet table or thought about what's coming, you'll kind of eat this because you're worried you're going to be hungry later, or you'll take a little bit of everything just in case you don't really like the next thing that's coming. So take the time to look at what's on the buffet table. Take the time to ask somebody, you know, what's the plan for the night, or if you know, if you're the one who's receiving, you know the plan for the day. Okay, I'm having, you know, an hors d'oeuvre at this time and an entree, a main course at that time, and whatever. So you know the plan, And so organize yourself around that. So if you let your eyes do the grazing, you might realize that you really love the Swedish meatballs, so you're going to have some of those. But you don't really care about the chicken wings.
Right.
So don't waste any time or energy or calories on chicken wings.
Okay.
So that's one thing. The other thing is to take a smaller plate. So
right.
try and when you're setting up the plates, when you're setting up the buffets, put out smaller plates. People can go back 17 times, but you have to at least then, you know, you can only put so much on your plate and then you have to go away. And that would be the next strategy, which would be if there's a buffet table or something, go in another room so you can sit down and eat and not be distracted by people coming in and out of the room, by seeing it out of the corner of your eye, something new just came to the table or something, so that you could just go sit and eat, enjoy what you're having, and then if you want to go make another pass at the table, that's fine.
I think that's a great idea. I think that's fantastic. And I wanted to ask you about this as well. You know, Kim, when it comes to holiday parties, sometimes the start times are all sort of wonky, I guess, because people are finishing work, you know, depending on what time they're finishing work and all that kind of stuff. So if the party is only starting at 7:30 or 8, should you snack or something before you leave your house?
That's a really great idea, Kelly, because if you don't, you get there and you're ravenous. And when you're really, 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 really hungry, that's when you feel like, you know, you cannot maintain your good intentions, right? So even if you walk in and you say, well, I'm not going to eat this, I'm not going to eat that, and then you're really starving, you're going to eat it anyways because it smells good, it tastes good, it looks good, and you're just so hungry, you can't wait for the next thing. So yes, for sure, have a balanced snack so that you arrive at the party and you're just, you know, just okay. So you're not too hungry and you're not full.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is dietitian Kim Airy. For more information, make sure to check out her website, kimairy.com. Kim, I wanted to ask you this as well, because I was thinking about this the other day. If you are hosting the party, how important is it for you to have like fruit out? Because I feel like if there's fruit, I feel if you have some of that, it sort of fills you up maybe, and then you're not maybe necessarily going after the chocolate cake.
Well, you know, I always tell everybody that, look, at least 50% of the people in the room, unless everybody is like under the age of 15, typically 50% of the people in the room are either watching their weight, worried about their cholesterol, their type 2 diabetes, or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that's pretty well a typical population. So for sure, you want to at least have a lighter dessert or a lighter a fruit salad. So, for example, at our house every year at Christmas, on the table, on the dessert table, will be either a fruit platter or fruit salad or a molded, you know, a jellied fruit salad that looks really pretty. So it looks like a really pretty and spectacular dessert, but it's lighter. And then if somebody who doesn't want to have, you know, such a heavy dessert doesn't have to have one.
If you are the person planning the party or hosting the party, what types of variety of foods do you want to see there, Kim? Like, what do you want a host to really keep in mind as they're planning this out?
Probably the biggest thing I like to encourage people to do is not to skimp on the veggies.
Okay.
A lot of people put all their emphasis on the desserts and on the main protein and the stuffing. You know, that's typically, you know, our people are worried about the turkey, the stuffing, the gravy, and the dessert. And then the fillers are missing. And it's really great if people have a lot of veggies that they can fill up on. So, yes, they can have a bit of turkey and enjoy it. And, yes, they can have, you know, but have lots of veggies available to people. Have raw veggies that you put out before as opposed to just having chips. You know, put out some raw veggies and dip, some crudité. Have some different variety, two or three cooked veggies that are you're serving with your dinner, or start your meal with a soup and then, you know, have a salad as well when you're serving the dinner. There's different ways of doing it, but make sure you get some veggies in there. I think the other thing to do is to look at ways to adapt your favorite recipes. I mean, do you really have to put cream in everything?
Mm-hmm.
Do you really have to use that much butter to get the result that you want? And the answer is probably no. if you, you know, some of us are really good in the kitchen and we're really amazing and we can, and it's not me, I need a recipe to do everything, but some people can go in the kitchen and, you know, look, know what to do and just make it leaner and make it delicious. Others of us need recipes, and there's ample recipe sites out there that you can go to that will provide you with delicious, low fat, low sugar, low salt recipes that, you know, I know that I try them out on my family, and my family only know that they're low fat because they're at a dietitian's house, right? So they know I'm trying stuff on them. But so, okay, what's she trying this time? But they don't know from the taste.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
they're not going, oh, we had to eat this. They're going, okay, Auntie Kim, that was really, really good. But what was different from when mom makes it?
Right. That's actually interesting you brought that up, because my mom just changed up how she does her potato salad. And she tried this lighter thing and she was like a bit worried. And then I actually tried it last night. And I actually haven't had her potato salad in like 3 years because it's such a process for her to make this thing that she doesn't do it all that often. But like when I tried it, what was interesting is right away my face lit up like a Christmas tree because I was so excited. And it tasted like it did, you know, 3 years ago. Like it tasted just the same. And she was so, you know, she was tickled pink that this change that she had made for the healthier option was great.
A lot of times, like if your mom is a really good cook and she can do that on her own, that's wonderful. And you're right. Most people don't know when you're giving them a healthy option. If you don't, you know, advertise it. I remember we used to do in restaurants, we used to go in and we used to change the menu. And when we would write on the menu, it's the heart healthy menu, nobody would buy it. And when we would not write it was a heart healthy menu, we'd just say, look, it's great pot roast today. People would line up for that same pot roast.
Wow.
The minute we would tell them it was heart healthy, they figured it would be yucky, right? But I think a lot of people also have this preconceived idea that if it's going to be healthy, it's not going to taste good.
Right.
So that's why, like I say, so just go to these websites. If you think you can't do it on your own, go looking. You can find them all over the place. And it just has amazing recipes and things are really delicious.
Something else I wanted to ask you about, which was interesting when it just sort of came to me, is the fact about the host themselves. Because, you know, the host themselves, whether it's one person or the couple that's trying to get this ready, you know, usually they've spent the whole day going nuts trying to get everything ready. And I know if I use my mom as an example, you know, when she used to do Christmas dinner all the time by herself and all this sort of stuff, like she was just going, and she still goes, you know, she still does Christmas for us too, but she just, it's like, you know, 90 miles an hour the whole day and she wants nothing to do with eating. So I find that you're either two extremes. You either don't eat, and then even when the food's ready, like I remember she would sort of sit down and have a bit of the turkey with us, but like I guess after looking at it all day, she didn't even want to taste it really. And then I've seen other people where, again, they're sort of, they've been going 90 miles an hour all day. And then when they actually sit down with their guests, it's like the hunger is caught up with them and then they go buck wild.
Yeah. Well, we usually actually, my clients will tell me both of those extremes. And one is because for sure some people are so busy cooking and working and getting everything done that they don't eat. And others are kind of snacking along the way. And as well, they just, you know, spent their whole day in it. They just don't want to know from it. So the one thing, the strategy that I always try and get everybody to do is to make sure that they plan, no matter how busy it gets, that they're going to take, even if it's only 10 minutes, where they're going to go sit in a corner and just have a little break and a little something to eat so that they're not going a long, long period of time without eating. So that's one thing we want to do. So that at that point, then they won't be overly hungry when they get to the end of the day. For the person who is really, 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 you know, not that hungry, I always tell them, well, go with it, but you're going to know that probably the next day, if you didn't eat that much, you know, on Christmas Day when you're really in it, you're not eating that much, it might be the next day when you wake up, you're going to be really hungry.
Right.
So the next day, you might want to plan to make sure that you've thought about that you're going to have a bigger breakfast, you know, and then have an idea, what are you going to eat the rest of the week? You might have leftovers, so you might have said, geez, I know I'm not going to eat my turkey today when I'm really, you know, cooked out and I'm really tired and I'm not enjoying it, but it's not a problem because I'm going to have leftovers for the rest of the week and I'm going to have my turkey dinner tomorrow. So then don't force yourself to eat that much on Christmas Day and or when the big meal is, and just have some the next day.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show, dietitian Kim Airy. For more information, check out her website, kimairy.com. I have to get this in before I let you go, Kim. The drinking situation. What types of drinks do you want to see people having at a holiday party or throughout the holidays? And how much can a drink really affect your caloric intake?
Okay, well, that's a big one. Okay, I guess the kind of drinks I want to see people having are the ones that have the least amount of stuff mixed into them. And by that, I mean, and this is what I always tell my kids, is if you're going to drink anything, you know, just drink, you know, alcohol. Don't waste your time on stuff that comes with lots of fruit juice in it or, you know, eggnog. I mean, a bowl of eggnog, a little cup of eggnog, depending on the recipe, can be anywhere from 350 to 500 calories.
Oh, my God.
and that's not from the alcohol, right? That's
right.
From all the other stuff that's in it. That's mm-hmm. almost like eating a meal, right?
Wow.
So that's really, really high. So I want you to stay away from that kind of thing. And if you're going to have a, you know, some bit of brandy or a bit of wine or whatever, I want you to have that, just plain. The other issue you want to remember, though, is not only are the calories from alcohol a big issue, the other issue with alcohol is that your good intentions kind of go out the window. Alcohol does a thing to, I guess, for lack of a better word, your willpower, and it leaves you with none. So you may have walked into a party and said, you know, I'm going to go in and I'm just going to take a small plate, and you've got all this plan in your mind, and then you have two glasses of wine, and then it's what plan?
Right.
Yeah. Now what plan? I have no plan. I'm just eating. Oh, this is fun. And then the next day you've, not only have you consumed a little bit of alcohol, but you've overconsumed on food. So then the couple of hundred calories that you got from alcohol is nothing compared to the extra calories you could have gotten from the food.
Okay. Kim, thank you so much for all of this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And I hope you all enjoy Christmas and New Year's and have great holidays.
Thanks very much, Kim. That is our dietitian, Kim Airy. Again, for more information, make sure to check out her website, kimairy.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Ever wish your kids came with instructions? You may have found yourself pulling some pretty crazy tactics just to try to get your child to listen or to do something. Today we have a few tips and advice that may help you. Christina Brockett is a working mom and author of The Missing Pages of the Parent Handbook. She's joining us to talk about some unique parenting tips that she's uncovered while writing her book. Christina, thank you for joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly. I really appreciate it. I look forward to having our discussion today.
So your latest book, The Missing Pages of the Parent Handbook, took you all over the place interviewing parents from all kinds of backgrounds. What actually sort of possessed you, if you will, to take on all of this?
You know, really, it began with my own feelings of inadequacy as a parent. I started writing some essays because I began to realize how little I knew what I was doing in terms of being a parent. And as I began to talk to friends and have these experiences, they looked at me like I was crazy and they said, you know what, we all feel this way. We all feel like we walked into a class and realized that we didn't have the answers to that parenting pop quiz. And it was really through talking to other people that I learned a lot about good parenting skills, through the experiences that other people had. And that opened up a two-year-long quest of interviewing parents of all ages and backgrounds all over the country.
Has there been a common theme, if you will, you know, as you've talked to all these parents, whether they have sort of youngsters or teens?
You know, there were some common themes that kind of came out of those series of interviews of some of the mistakes that parents make. One of them being comparing children to each other, whether it be comparing a sibling to another or comparing your child to a peer. When we have that natural reaction to compare children or compare anything, frankly, in life, we do a compare and contrast. But when we compare children to other children, sometimes we end up with these unrealistic expectations. And really, we need to meet the children wherever they are, developmentally, emotionally, et cetera. That was one of them. The other one that kind of goes along with that, which is taking a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, there's a plethora of books out there and blogs and all sorts of things that you can learn from in terms of developing tools and techniques to parent a child with a variety of situations or issues. But ultimately, that advice needs to be taken with a grain of salt because every child is different, and what you or I or any parent brings to the table in terms of our background is going to be different. So there really can't be a parenting one-size-fits-all mentality. We've got to take what we learn out there and customize it to our child and, frankly, to the situation. The third one is a really biggie, which is not setting boundaries. You know, what is cute at 2 is not necessarily cute at 12. And when I talked to parents, especially those who had then grown children, they said, you know, it's exhausting holding to those boundaries, but ultimately it'll pay off later on. The next one is modeling behavior. You know, if we want our children to exhibit behavior, we really need to be their models of that behavior, treating each other with respect, treating our children with respect. If we don't demonstrate the behavior we want our children to mimic, then it's not a realistic expectation that they're going to know how to behave and really mimic that behavior. And the last one, which I know I'm really guilty of, and many mothers I have found especially are guilty of, is not making time for yourself. You know, we live in a society that is very devoted and very kid-centric. But when we focus entirely on our children and we don't make time for ourselves, we kind of become a casualty of our own life. And our children then don't have a full appreciation for who we are outside of being a mother or a father in their life. And in order to be a good parent, you also need to take care of yourself and show that you have respect enough for yourself to make yourself a priority as well, just as a more balanced approach to the whole family unit. Those were the five biggies that I think came out of the series of interviews that I did.
I think that's really fascinating. It was funny, as you were talking, I just had all these examples sort of pop up in my head.
And, pop up?
Yeah, and it's crazy because I'm not a mom myself at the moment, but I have lots of nieces and a nephew. And it's interesting because as not being a parent, it's easy to sort of Monday morning quarterback what your siblings are doing with their kids. And it's really hard. Like it's, you know, and even it's funny because when I watch my nieces and stuff, like they're just such polar opposite. And one of them really has a tendency to sort of be like a little mom herself. But it's like you try to make sure that she doesn't be the big kid all the time, that she doesn't need to be. But she very much protects her little sister, and her little sister looks up to her. And there's only like 2 years difference, and she's only 5. So it's really interesting to sort of pull yourself back from making her be more responsible than she needs to be, especially because she acts like she can anyways.
Exactly. And that goes back to meeting your child wherever they are, because, you know, she may act more sophisticated for a 5-year-old in comparison to somebody else. And so you transfer these sort of unrealistic expectations because of how mature she acts, that, and you forget she's only 5.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that happens very frequently. And I mean, none of this stuff is really rocket science, but I think, you know, sometimes it's just somebody saying it out loud, just bringing you back to ground zero and saying, okay, you're right. I need to focus on these basics, because we can get caught up in a lot of the detailed stuff out there. And sometimes it just gets back to basics.
Right.
You know, that sounds cliche, but it's true.
But yeah, and I think it's important, I guess, and I get why parents can't always do this, because, like, you know, I just see my brother and my sister, and, you know, they've got 2 kids each, and it's exhausting. You know, I'm certain I have them for 3 hours and I'm ready to hand them back. So I can only imagine what it's like 24/7. But I think it's interesting how, you know, because the kids keep hammering on you, like that, you know, like they have no like shut off button. So you might tell them no 19 times, but it's like you still have to go to time 21 really just to make sure that they get it. Because, and then I could see how you can't really see outside of it, outside of the situation you're in.
Absolutely. And that saying no, like you're talking about, it is so exhausting. You know, you didn't hear me the first 20 times I said no.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I tell my own children is I'm not doing my job as a parent by enforcing what I said my answer was to begin with. Because if I change my answer to you now, every other time you ask me, you're going to expect that I'm going to change my answer. And then I'm not doing my job as a parent. So this is the answer. And they don't like it. But again, it's that sort of constant coaching or that constant like pushing back in order to finally get them to really understand what you're saying and adhere to those boundaries. Because if you don't adhere to them, they'll push. They mm-hmm. will push that line as far as they possibly can. And it's our job to make sure we hold it firm. And it's hard.
Do you find
it's
it
really hard.
Difficult or, you know, in your research, when kids are older, you know, like teens, but like later teens, like 16, 17, 18, you know, a question that I would have is, you know, I think sometimes the parents at that age either end up or want to be on some level more their friend than their parent. Not, you know, not all the time, but or it ends up happening. But how do you sort of bridge that line between like still, you know, I am your parent and you're not staying out till 1 a.m. with the fact that, you know, let's say 80% of the time, you can sort of treat them as a mature, almost an adult, and then it's these times that just, you know, end up going wrong.
You know, I've talked to parents who have had teenagers. My children, my son is almost 12, so he's in that tween stage. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of parents about that very issue. And the ones that have done it successfully or, you know, really have very good relationships with their children and their children understand and respect their boundaries are those who tell their children up front, I love you, but I am not going to be your best friend
mm-hmm.
because I need to be your parent. And we can do a lot of fun things, but at the end of the day, you know, I may give you rules and things that you're not going to like, but if I didn't do that, then I'm not doing my job as a parent. And I think that's where the danger zone kind of comes in because those lines, those blurred lines develop. If you're buddy with your child, they then think that you're more like a peer to them and that whatever your rules are that you're setting forth as a parent aren't as applicable. And, you know, the clearer the boundaries are, I think, just based on the people that I've spoken to, the easier it is to tackle things going forward.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is author and mom, Christina Brockett. For more information, make sure to check out her website, ChristinaBrockett.com. Christina, I wanted to ask you this because I think there's such polar opposites when it comes to people on this next sort of topic. When it comes to like spanking or not spanking, like I know in the last several years, it's totally, you know, all the parents have turned to, you know, timeouts and all that kind of stuff. And I know that it works quite well, I would say a lot of the time. But it's funny because a friend of mine, she, you know, completely does not believe in any sort of spanking or any of that. And I was raised with spanking, but I can tell you that I was probably only spanked 5 times in my entire childhood, like right up until, you know, 18. Not that you'd spank a 15-year-old, but you know what I mean? Like I probably was only spanked 5 times. And I actually don't have a problem with it. Like I deserved it. There was never not one time that I didn't sort of deserve that. And my feeling is I guess I kind of view it like the animal kingdom a bit. Like if you ever watch these wildlife documentaries, you see occasionally like the lioness, like she nips the, you know, the little cubs from going too close to the river or, you know what
right.
I mean? Like, and that's how I view, I obviously don't ever think a parent should hit their kid in the face. I don't think there should be verbal abuse. I don't think they should, you know, get out a belt, but like I was just spanked with the hand, you know, like again, I think 5 times in my whole existence. But having that knowledge of that, I think gave me a really healthy respect for my parents. And I knew never to cross the line. I wasn't scared of them, but I knew that there was a bigger consequence if I kept pushing.
Yeah, that is an incredibly controversial topic. And, you know, I've got polarized camps, even in my network of people that I'm friends with, even some of the people that I had interviewed. You know, there are differing camps and viewpoints on that topic. I, too, remember on occasion getting spanked when I was growing up. And I think that time frame was a little bit different than it is now. In terms of that whole idea of spanking or not spanking, you know, every parent, and this goes back to deciding that one-size-fits-all approach, needs to ultimately go with what they are most comfortable with. I personally did not invoke any spanking in my house, and my husband remembers being spanked as a child too. We made a conscious decision that that was not the tack that we were going to take, and the reason primarily for that was as our children got older, you know, if you want to send them to preschool and you are telling a child it's not okay to hit, but you're hitting them at home because you're spanking them or even you're spanking them on the hand, etc., you're sending conflicting messages. So, you know, it creates a lot of confusion, whereas for us, and that's where I can talk from my personal experience, it was very consistent. We don't hit you at home. We don't expect you to hit other children. And very clear line, there was no, well, mommy does it differently at home, but you can't do it because you're only really little. Because realistically speaking, you know, when you're talking to especially a very young child, they're not going to understand the difference.
Right.
So.
Right. And I wanted to ask you as well, you know, throughout your conversations with parents, when it comes to the behaviors, I guess, that certain kids go through, and I think a lot of kids go through this as they grow up, you know, all of a sudden you might have a kid who was fine one day and the next day has started to bite or the next day has started to hit. How do parents deal with that and curb that behavior?
When the child starts exhibiting behavior that they've never exhibited before, it's funny that you mentioned biting because we were fine. My daughter didn't bite, no problems whatsoever. And she turned around one day and totally bit her brother and on the back. I mean, it was just such a bizarre thing, but she was angry with him and that's how she was demonstrating her anger. And at that point in time, we tried to figure out where did this behavior come from. I mean, clearly we don't walk around biting each other. So, mm-hmm. you know, that wasn't it. When it comes to starting exhibiting behaviors, a child is acting out. And the question is, why are they acting out? And where did they learn the behavior and learn that that was okay? And really it becomes sort of a detective thing where you try to research and understand whether it be a preschool or a daycare setting or even something that they are learning in play dates. Sometimes it could be as simple as being around other kids that they exhibit behaviors. And frankly, it goes beyond just the biting or the hitting or things that you see in really young kids. We have a circle of friends, and sometimes my children will come back emulating behaviors of their friends, maybe a sassy attitude or a mean girl kind of approach, and you realize where it's coming from, and then you just redirect and saying, you know, this isn't okay. But a lot of it is understanding where it's coming from and then reinforcing those boundaries again and continuing to do so until the undesirable behavior ceases.
I want to ask you this as well. This is obviously a hot topic. It's obviously been around for forever and ever, but the last couple of years, I would say it's getting more attention, which is bullying. And I'm wondering what, you know, is your take on that? Because obviously you can have a bully as young as whatever age, you know, and then it goes into the teen years. And now with social media, that's like a whole other level of bullying. So what's your situation on all of that?
Bullying is really scary, especially with social media out there. And, you know, you can't control other children's behavior, but this comes back to really understanding and being aware of what's going on with your own child from the perspective, say, if your child is getting bullied at school, looking for changes in behavior, withdrawal patterns, things like that, and really working with the people that are involved. If it's a school setting, I know that there are a lot of jurisdictions that have very firm policies on bullying, and immediately getting in touch with the school counselor, et cetera, to put a stop to that bullying at the very beginning. And unfortunately, social media, especially in the tween years, is horrible. And, you know, it just, it presents another layer and another extra challenge for parents. And it's a continuous battle. I know of somebody who's got a daughter in middle school, and, you know, they've had to get her into counseling and all sorts of things because she's completely depressed because she's getting bullied at school. And they've talked to school counselors and are even talking about moving or pulling her out and homeschooling her. And, you know, on the flip side, as a parent, I think that, you know, we need to do our job as parents from a very early age with children to let them know that that type of behavior, the bullying behavior, is not acceptable. Because if you don't start curbing it when they're young, it will just continue to develop. And, you know, they need to know that it's not okay. That's kind of both sides of the coin.
Right, right, right. And I have so many questions to ask you, but I know we're running out of time. But I just wanted to ask you, I guess, two final questions.
Sure.
One would be with regards to siblings. Like, how do you handle if, you know, you have a sibling who is, wherever they are in the lineup, but they're more sensitive. And then you have one that's a bit more sort of outgoing and aggressive, or not even aggressive, but just like assertive, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Do parents have a problem with dealing with that? Because I know sometimes it's so easy to be like, well, your sister's not acting like a baby, you know?
Yeah, no, it's so funny that you bring that parallel out, because that describes my two children to the T. My son is the older one. He is completely sensitive. He's more of an introvert. My daughter would be the life of a party and, you know, completely an extrovert. And she has no idea. She will stand up for herself. My son will not. And it's very difficult. And I think we just, as parents, when you are faced with siblings that have very different emotional needs, you've got to be really careful in terms of making those comparisons. And even more importantly, making sure that the sibling doesn't put too much pressure, especially if it's sort of that sensitive versus the extrovert, put too much pressure on perhaps the more sensitive sibling to push them to behave in a certain way, because then they will feel a level of inadequacy and comparison. And it's just, it's a real challenge. And I think it just goes back to having to keep yourself in check. And again, it gets to be exhausting, but
right,
it's the only way to do it.
And finally, I just wanted to ask you what main thought or main tip you wanted to leave with our audience.
You know, the one tip that I would say is parenting is going to throw you curveballs, and it's in those curveballs that I think you can learn the most about yourself, and you can probably grow as much or the most as a person. And at the end of the day, most importantly, if you think you're going to laugh about it, you might as well start laughing now, because life's too short.
Excellent. Christina, you rock. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That was our author and mom, Christina Brockett. Again, for more information and tips, make sure to check out her website, ChristinaBrockett.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We are very excited to be joined by Canadian DJ, producer, and artist Glenn Morrison, who's having international success with his amazing music. Glenn, thank you for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So, Glenn, can we start off actually, you know, for people who might just be getting used to who you are, especially because some of my listeners are actually overseas in Australia and Japan. So can you tell us, like, how you got into music, and was this always a plan for you?
Yes. I think that for me, I've had a long history of being involved in the music industry to some degree. When I was around 4 years old, I was studying under the Royal Conservatory of Music just for classical piano, and I was competing in Canada at various competitions and festivals, but, you know, pretty much relegated in that Beethoven, Chopin, Mozart kind of world. And it was wonderful. You know, there was very heavy theory lessons that I had to learn over the in that, you know, first 10 years of my life, but it benefited me, I think, very well in terms of having, you know, chordal theory and little hooks and melodies embedded in the subconscious. So it certainly has helped in terms of my my writing approach for today as a producer. But you know, yeah, it's been a long history of, you know, I look at them kind of like chapters in a book, and it's kind of like whenever there's one chapter that finishes, there's something else that's exciting and interesting that's new and fresh, and I think that keeps me alive as an artist and makes me feel free to explore different avenues and keep an open mind.
I wanted to get your take on people who have a problem with, you know, EDM or dance music or whatever you want to call it in that vein, who always just say it's so computer based. Obviously, you are a musician. You know how to play actual instruments. So
yes.
What do you say to like, because I get really upset when rock acts get all high and mighty and like, well, you know, it's not guitar and whatever. So like, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of ignorance attached to that kind of perception of, well, these people that are making electronic music don't know what they're, you know, they don't know how to play instruments. That's just crazy when you think about it. The electronic music is an instrument in itself, not necessarily, you know, DJ turntables, but when you're working in the studio, you know, you're building layers, you're creating harmonies, you're doing riffs. It's absolutely no different than any other, you know, stylistic preference other than the fact that maybe you don't happen to play guitar or maybe you don't play violin, but I mean, like I said, I'm a classical pianist from the roots of all my musical upbringing. So for me, I can, you know, be very adaptive and kind of like a chameleon in the studio. I mean, with the advent of technology as well, that's, you know, has been so amazing in the last 5 to 10 years, especially for studio producers. You know, the quality of the software can be so high as well. Herbie Hancock, an amazing musician, is also endorsing a very particular type of software for the piano these days, because it just replicates, you know, various models of pianos like the Steinway D or the Bechstein or the Yamaha, and it sounds very, very real. And I mean, I have a very special piano that was bequeathed to me by my grandmother. There's only like 3 in the world, and it has ivory keys, and it's a Heinzmann. It's a kind of a mix between a baby grand and a grand. It's a very special piano. But I'll tell you honestly that when I was, you know, recording myself just for like classical practicing many years ago, then to now have, you know, the high-end software there, you know, with all the miking options you can do, it sounds like a real piano has been recorded in a room. And it's amazing where we are right now with technology. So getting back to the, you know, the original question about, you know, whether we can play instruments, I think the proof is in the pudding, and in terms of being able to come up with great songs. You know, there is an emphasis doesn't matter what the type of genre is, but there's always an emphasis from the record labels or the radio people or the fans to have great songs. And you know, you can go on and on about how, you know, pop radio is simple, and you always hear these little arguments that flitter around, you know, but there's no substantiated proof to that, because if records were so easy to make, then everybody would be making them, you know. The idea of being able to take your emotions and translate that on a musical canvas is a real gift and an art in itself too, and it takes a lot of time to hone in on that craft and to get better and to push yourself into being a better artist, and that's kind of where my whole headspace is at too. I'm always willing and being open-minded to growing as an artist, trying different stylistic approaches, all in the hopes that I can create music that translates to people, whether you're 5 years old or 65 years old. And that's something that means a lot to me.
When it comes to creating your tracks, is it important for you to write lyrics first? Do you get the melody first? And how do you incorporate the beat? Like, do you have like a set formula, or do you always sort of change it up?
There's no fixed way of working, but for me, as a general rule, what I like doing is just kind of sitting in the studio, coming up with like an instrumental that sounds really strong, have it fully arranged, mixed, mastered, everything, and then from that we go to you know, various lyricists or top liners or vocalists to say, here, let's try to now, you know, bring the record home, so to speak, and deliver that, you know, quote unquote knockout punch. Let's get the vocals in there and bring it home. So, and of course, you know, once you come up with a good vocal demo, you can always add little accoutrements or little tiny things, you know, in post production after you've done the vocal tracking. But yeah, generally speaking, as a rule of thumb for me and the way I like to work, is I like to come up with the instrumentals first, and then work on getting the vocals applied after.
Can you talk to us about your remix career? I know you've done some mixes for a lot of, you know, A-line artists like Pharrell and Cher and all that. How did that work come about?
that work was really pitched to me by various record labels. So they would come to me and with, you know, I guess the stuff that I was already doing in the electronic music world, they would just say, look, we have a project here, this is the brief, and this is the budget, and how do you feel about doing this? And again, this kind of plays in part to what I was saying to you before, you know, about just trying to be open-minded and creative and try different projects. Even with my work with IMAX last year, it was definitely unfamiliar territory, but one in which I fully embraced. I mean, IMAX is a wonderful company, great people working there, and they just approached me to say, look, we have this project. We would love you to be a part of it with your, you know, and with your expertise and music making ability. Would you like to try this with us? And of course, it's something that, you know, is exciting to me. So I feel like that's kind of the nature of, I mean, this transcends even just the music industry, but the nature of work and a career in general, you know, the idea of being able to just do something a little different, the spice of life, as they say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to just do something to push yourself that's a little different. Otherwise, you're going to be perceived as a one-trick pony that just kind of does the same thing over and over again, you know?
And Glenn, do you want to work with more unknown artists and sort of have them on your tracks? Or, you know, do you want to go after, let's say, I don't know, like a Rihanna or a Kelly Clarkson or something? And, like, do you like bringing something new to the table, or do you also like that balance of having, you know, an established artist?
That's a great question. No, I think, to be honest with you, it's for me mostly important about not necessarily the station of an artist in terms of whether they're, you know, popular or just like a developing artist, but the way in which their headspace is, you know, like the way in which they want to work and their attitude. And it's kind of a combination for me. I'm at a point now, very luckily, where I can be selective about what kind of projects I want to take on and which ones I want to kind of put, you know, pass on.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm mostly interested in people that are in the same kind of headspace as myself. Like, I'm just very passionate about music, and I'm trying to do the best that I can, you know, the best music that I can make with no false pretenses. And I just really value artists that are in that kind of headspace where they are trying their best to do the best that they can, and that they're you know, the talent, whether it's developing artists or big artists, you know, there's many people I'd love to work with. And I think it's just a case of, you know, writing a record is also a very personal thing too, because it's almost like you're creating something from nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you're trying to convey a certain feeling or emotion from nothing. So writing with somebody or working with somebody is a deeply personal experience, and I think the attitude of somebody, for me at least, is very important into deciding whether or not I want to continue working with that person or wanting to finishing a record or whatever, you know?
Joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show is Canadian DJ, producer, and artist Glenn Morrison. Make sure to check him out on his website, morrisonrecordings.com. Glenn, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the future. Like, where do you want to head? Like, do you want to be, like, you know, a Deadmau5, a Tiësto, like, you know, all of that? Or do you want to be more artistic, I feel? Because, like, your track Goodbye is so great, and I feel like a connection to it, and I'm sure a lot of your fans do as well. So do you want to head more in that direction?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, for me, the positive response from Goodbye and the fact that it's also in my home country, no less, is such a wonderful feeling. Like, if anything, it's kind of given me confidence to keep doing this kind of style and be working in this headspace. I, you know, this is only my second commercial release that was from my album deal, so I really feel like I'm at the tip of the iceberg with this particular way of writing. And it's, again, I was saying to you even before the interview started, like, it's kind of, This is something I'm welcoming with open arms, and I'm just learning. I'm trying to immerse myself in this new world, this Billboard world, the radio world, and it's fascinating to me, all the different metrics and how you guys look at records and the test subject groups and all this stuff is very fascinating to me. And I just look at this as a wonderful experience, and I'm very, very passionate. Again, I know I kind of keep flogging that point, but I'm just very passionate about what I'm doing, and I'm very excited also to showcase a lot of the records that are on my album right now. Currently, we have around 25 tracks. Of course, I'm going to truncate it and bring it down, but you know, the next single, for example, that will follow after Goodbye, I'm very excited to see what the public reaction will be like to that, and the radio reaction. For me, this is a very exciting process, and I'm just trying to take one day at a time and keep a humble head and be very focused.
Now, I have to ask you this, Glenn, because I'm always interested to know in an artist, like, what their influences are, because I feel like their influences from when they were a kid, like a teenager, you know, sort of taste or flavor what they're doing now. So who were you, like, super into as a kid?
I love answering this question because my influences are varied and far over, like all over the place. I mean, from obviously the classical side of things, there was Debussy and Tchaikovsky and Chopin and Beethoven. But then when I was growing up, I loved Green Day, the Dookie album, The Offspring, Smash. You know, Metallica stuff I used to love. Nine Inch Nails was still to this very day. Trent Reznor is a very, very big inspiration for me. I'm just thinking off the cuff. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Even the early days of Max Martin and Dr. Luke's writings with the Backstreet Boys, that was great pop dance writing. I mean, essentially, it was really, really good pop dance stuff. I used to listen to everything. I'm just trying to think off the cuff. Prodigy was amazing. Mm-hmm. I really love the Prodigy. And then today we go, come full circle where I'm always constantly looking at the new stuff as well, like the Mumford & Sons, I Will Wait. I love the chorus and that. When I was at the Grammys and I watched them perform that, it was just like, it was so impacting. It made me really stop and just go, wow, I have a lot of room to grow as an artist, and I want to be at that point. I want to be writing records like that. And even though that had nothing to do with electronic music, I was inspired by it. And there's the Imagine Dragons stuff that's great, and the Lord Royals, I'm really into that record. I think it's very, very well produced. And there's just so much great music out there, and I constantly am trying to be inspired by different things. Even Philip Glass and some of these, Brian Eno and Sting. I mean, I love music that comes from the heart, where there's real substance to it, or at least how I perceive, substance. And It inspires me and humbles me to try to strive to do better myself. If I even look at the growth pattern from where I was when I first started writing records to where I am now, it's amazing to see that evolution and transformation of myself as an artist. And it only makes me wonder where will I be in 5 or 10 years? I'm talking stylistically in this sense. Like I really don't know, but I'm just trying to create the best possible music I can and music that I feel, and I hope that it resonates with people.
Glenn, thank you so much for your time. You're awesome. We really enjoyed having you. We can't wait to keep supporting your music.
Thank you. It means a lot to me. Thank you for having me.
That is Canadian DJ and producer and artist Glenn Morrison. Again, make sure to check him out on his website, morrisonrecordings.com.
Hey, this is Glenn Morrison, and you're listening to my new single, Goodbye, on The Kelly Alexander Show.
It's enough that I know our time had a home in your heart was a place, but the glass always breaks. From the start we were brave, yet it all seemed amazing. Now
Kelly Alexander Show.
A big thank you going out to my guests this week, Kim Airy, Christina Brockett, and of course, Glenn Morrison. I want to leave you with a thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from Norman Schwarzkopf. Leadership is a potent combination of strategy and character, but if you must be without one, be without the strategy. Thank you so much for hanging out on the show. Always appreciate your time. Don't forget to follow us on all of our social media, including on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Lots of great interviews there. And also on Twitter, @KAlexanderShow. And of course, Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.